Harvey Weinstein, the movie mogul behind some of Hollywood's biggest hits, is behind bars tonight. He was convicted by a New York jury today of rape and committing a criminal sexual act after a month-long trial featuring testimony from multiple women who said he assaulted them. While he was acquitted of three other charges, the 67-year-old could still face decades in prison. Today's verdict was the end of a stunning fall from grace for one of the movie industry's most powerful men.
During the month-long trial, jurors heard from six women who described in detail how Weinstein allegedly sexually abused them. More than 80 women have accused the movie mogul of sexual abuse, harassment, and threats. Among them, model Amber Gutierrez, who was outside the courthouse today.
It means a lot. It's a start.
That sentiment was echoed on a conference call with actress Rose McGowan.
Today is not a referendum on Me Too. This is taking out the trash.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm a casting director and the host of the podcast Killer Casting. And I'm also on the advisory board for Hire Survivors Hollywood. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst.
And I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer producer of Criminal Minds. And with us today, we have two very special guests.
Hi, I'm Sarah Ann Massey. I'm an actor, writer, filmmaker, comedian, singer, Harvey Weinstein survivor and founder of Hire Survivors Hollywood.
And also with us today is...
And I'm Rowena Chu. I worked for Harvey in 1998 and Zelda Perkins and I were forced to sign an NDA. My story went public in 2019 and I am now working as an activist and an advocate around the Me Too movement.
Thank you so much for joining us again. And we're going to just jump right into our conversation with you. In what way were you involved with the film, She Said? It tells so much of your story. It flips back and forth in time. It depicts you as you were at the time of your assault, a young 24-year-old assistant. But then it also flashes forward in time, you as a mature mother and a woman who is not so sure she wants to just break open her life and tell her story to two New York Times journalists. So what was your experience with the film?
I think as real life survivors, we actually had relatively little to do with the film. We did take an initial meeting. So Laura, Zelda and I met with Dee Dee long before there was even a script. In fact, we met at the point when we met with Dee Dee, there wasn't even a book. So that's kind of fascinating. Mm. The book hadn't been written yet. Plan B had bought the film rights. So it was a bit of a surreal meeting in the sense that we had talked about a creative product that didn't yet exist. And there was an assumption that Laura and Zelda's stories would be featured in the book, but I actually hadn't signed up to be featured in the book. So it was extremely exploratory. We met with Dee Dee in January 2019. I didn't start speaking to Jodie and Megan about featuring in the book until May 2019. So in January, I was fairly certain that I didn't want my story to go public. I wasn't going to appear in either a book or some feature film that would come in the future. So it was very nebulous, that original meeting. But we did sort of talk about, you know, if your story were to be featured, what are the things that would really matter? And right from the get-go, I said, if my story is to be used, I would like to be culturally authentically portrayed in the sense that I would want, you know, one of my prerequisites would be that an Asian actor should be used to portray my story. And in fact, not even just an Asian actor.
Yeah.
I know the temptation is going to be to cast someone Asian American because they have far bigger profile and there's a bigger pool to choose from. But if my story is at all going to be featured, I would like to request a British Chinese actress. And that was said in the first meeting. That was really only ever one meeting with Dee Dee. So I think it's interesting that we met so early and that there was only that one meeting, really. I think people assume that the real life survivors were much more involved with the making of the movie than we in fact were. My next contact with the film at all was after the book was out, after I went public. So some months, maybe even some years later, I sat down with, again, one session with Rebecca Lenkovitz to talk through my story. And at that point, she was writing the first draft. After that, we got to see an early draft online. But, you know, our contact with the film was really only about once a year.
So, and I don't know how typical that is. I haven't spoken to any other real life people that were depicted in other movies. I don't know whether other movies do things differently. I think we didn't really connect with the film that much. The film is an incredible piece. It is a real testament to all of the women who pulled together to make it. It is, of course, predominantly a story of Jodie and Megan and their pursuit. But also, you know, when I look at the work that Dee Dee and Rebecca and Maria, you know, all incredible women put in, I think it's interesting that the film's subject matter is about all women coming together to achieve an incredible thing. And then the film itself is a microcosm of that because it's a group of team of incredible women that have pulled together. That said, it isn't predominantly a survivor story. It's not a survivor-centric story. It's a journalist-centric story. And I think there is still a story to be told that is survivor-centric. Whether or not that's ever going to come forward is an interesting point. I think Lisa was a person who mentioned the term soft shunning. I will say that survivors, I think, are having quite a lot of difficulty getting their raw, undiluted stories commissioned, whether or not that's a book or a movie or a stage play. I think that society and audiences and perhaps commissioners and those that hold the purse strings really struggle with the idea that survivors will come forward and tell their own story in their own voice, you know, unfettered by a so-called neutral authority, such as a journalist. And I think that issue is a bit of a stopper, actually, to survivor stories coming forward.
It's interesting you say that. And, you know, my company, XG Productions, we, during the pandemic, had to pivot almost completely to audio because there wasn't any real film production going on. But we started out with the survivor story, the survivor sisters from the Golden State Killer. And we had four of them who wanted to tell their story, and we let them tell their story in their own words. It's very little narration, mostly them telling their story and the investigators piecing together the investigation. And that is an accepted approach in audio, at least now. But you're right. Hollywood wants the you know, the curious investigator or the curious journalist or the, you know, the young person who discovers something that they want to tell that story. And OK, we can kind of bring in some survivor stuff in there, but they do shy away from, you know, from the pure survivors telling their story. But maybe we could change that.
Right. And the literary,
I mean,
and the literary
world. This is a good start being here.
And the literary world as well. There actually have been very few memoirs published directly of sexual assault survivors that have been commercially successful. You know, right. Chanel Miller's book is an example of something that broke above that. But overall, there's a bit of a glass ceiling for survivor stories to be directly told in memoir format. And I think, you know, to your point about what Hollywood is looking for, I think Hollywood is still very wedded to the hero narrative. And it is much easier to tell a hero story of two journalists who did an amazing thing and who rescued women from silence and persuaded them to jump together. I mean, that is a hero narrative that is very compelling. I think it is really difficult for audience members, even people who have themselves been sexual assault survivors, to see the sexual assault survivor narrative as a hero narrative. I think it's complicated. I think society still has issues around blaming the survivor, blaming the victim. Oh, surely she knew better. Surely she knew of Harvey's reputation. What was she doing in the hotel room anyway? What was she wearing? Why didn't she run? Who does she tell afterwards? Was she sufficiently traumatized? You know, these questions are coming up in the trial, which is a legal point of record. So I think that we are still a long way from society moving away from this victim blaming approach.
Yeah, I agree. And I just while we were talking today, I just got a message from a friend of mine. His name is Stephen Mills, and he wrote a book called Chosen about his victimization as a teen. And he just got nominated. Well, he just won today the National Jewish Book Award. So he was at a Jewish sponsored camp, and they were not helpful during the investigation. And but yet they just nominated him as the best book of the year award. So maybe there's hope, you know, that his is a memoir. It's totally a survivor story. And
that's great.
And yeah. And, you know,
tremendous.
And yeah, it would be nice to see a version of that with a female. You know, maybe that's coming out soon, hopefully. But the point is
a female of color would be amazing.
It would be amazing.
But,
so, perhaps we should help you get there, you know.
Yeah, both but of I'm you, still you know? Getting really interesting feedback. You know, really? They will say things like, you know, I've been working on a memoir for 3 years, and they will say things like, well, I think this story's already been done. You know, there's been lots of Me Too books out. You know, for instance, Catch and Kill and She Said. And so I point out, well, okay, but Catch and Kill and She Said were from the point of view of the journalist. I see that as an entirely different book. And that right. doesn't really play, which is very fascinating. Or they'll say things like, I don't know about the survivor of color story. I think that's a little niche. You know, only Asian Americans are going to be really interested in reading it. And so
niche.
I'm like, but on the one hand, one publisher said this was over commercial and overexposed. And on the other hand, someone said only Asian Americans are going to read it, which is actually true. So I think there is a societal struggle that's echoed in that of literary agents and editors and publishers and the gatekeepers of this industry,
right.
where it's just very difficult to position a survivor memoir.
I'd like to speak a little to that in terms of it within Hollywood, because I'm a writer as well, right? So I see this from both sides of it. And I think there's two things going on. One is that if you're putting money behind a film, you want to know that the person who's writing it has a track record of success. But the problem with that is that there aren't opportunities being given to the people who would authentically tell these stories in the first place. So right. it goes back to that idea of who is having the door slammed in their face and why. And we need to ensure that people who are writers and have these authentic stories to tell, or even if you're not a writer and have an authentic story to tell, can team up with somebody and actually tell that story together. And I have an example from my own life where I wrote and produced a short film a few years ago called Tristan and Kelly, and this filmmaker had seen it and really loved it and knew that I was a survivor through me talking about what had happened with Harvey. And she said, look, I wrote this feature. It's partially a survivor story. I'm not a survivor. Would you give it a read? I would really love to hear what you think. Please give me your honest notes. And I did. And she went back to her production company with my notes, and they asked if I would come on board as a co-writer and do a complete wow. rewrite of the script. And it's called Our Culture. We're in like pre-production development for that right now. And it's an immigrant story. And it's a survivor story. And Alexa Pilar, the original writer, is an immigrant. And she could speak really authentically to that part of this character's story. Mm. And I'm a survivor, and I could speak really authentically to that. And I think we combine to create something that tells this really honest story that doesn't always get told from the right perspective. And there are people interested. So I think once people get the opportunity, there is a market for it. There are buyers for it. There are clearly an audience for it. We just have to get to the point of doing that. And it's another thing we advocate for with our organization. And there's an organization called Storyline Partners that does something similar, which is if you want to tell a story about a marginalized community and you're not from that community, hire consultants or hire co-writers who are actually those people who have those lived experiences. So I think there's still a lot of progress to be made. And I think there's a lot of stories that get told about true crime that don't come from those survivors of that, or don't come from those communities, don't even consult with them.
Right.
And I don't watch those programs. I don't see those films, because if you're going to benefit off of the real stories of people, you know, you should include them. You should make sure that they're benefiting too. And I you know, it's not sexual violence, but Judas and the Black Messiah, they hired Chairman Fred Hampton's family to consult on that film. And it was such a beautiful film and such an honest depiction. I think it makes the end product better. So not only is it like the morally right thing to do, and not only is it the, you know, intentional thing to do and gives you the clearest idea of what the actual story is, but it's better for business. And I just wish people would listen to that. I sometimes think, like, if I can reach you by talking about the bottom line and get you to do the right thing that way, then fine. But understand that authentic storytelling is always going to be more compelling storytelling.
And it depends who's commissioning, doesn't it? I mean, oftentimes it is male commissioners, and, you know, they don't understand the nuanced detail of the female experience. That's my experience in Hollywood and storytelling, where, you know, it's the attitude, oh, well, we've heard one survivor story, we've heard them all, as if there isn't nuance in each person's experience. And I remember with Dirty John and Deborah Newell's story, when we were telling that, and I wanted to then help Tonya, the wife of John for 10 years, tell her story. And the amount of people who said, well, we know this story, don't we? And, well, no, we know how the story ends, but we didn't know Tonya's experience of 10 years, and we didn't know the John Meehan psychosocial development that got him to those places to make the decisions that he did, so that we ask questions of him and his behavior, rather than, to Rowena's point, we ask the question of the wrong person all the time. Even in our storytelling, we focus on what she did or what she didn't do because it's easier. And unless you really understand abuse and violence and coercive control and the whole entrapment, then you're going to be telling the stories in a similar way all the time, which is what makes what you're doing, Sarah Ann, so important. And Rowena, you know, telling your stories, and I'm always a big advocate of people telling their stories in their own words, unfiltered. And that's what we did with Tonya's story. It was an audible, John Meehan's Reign of Terror. And Tonya was the investigator. She thought she knew her own story, right? But when we started, and I said to Tonya, we will uncover things that you will not be expecting. Are you ready for this? And she thought that she did know most of it, but wow, was she wrong? We uncovered so much history that was so relevant that made Tonya understand her experience far better. And then she could process her trauma properly. And Rowena, you talked a little bit just about trauma and the secret that sometimes we keep. Our body always keeps the score, but sometimes when we have to keep these secrets or we can't tell our story in the way that we need to, it can be very corrosive to our soul, can't it, in terms of our own health and our own psychosocial well-being. So the storytelling part, being able to tell your story unfiltered in a way that you want to, absolutely so important.
Thank you. It is.
I don't want us to leave before we go back and talk about something that is a cautionary tale for so many people. And that is the NDA that you were asked to sign. I think a lot of our listeners are not aware of this absolutely abhorrent, manipulative thing that when you reported the sexual assault, you reported it to your direct report, Zelda, and you went to them and you really wanted to hold Harvey's feet to the fire and make him accountable. And then you were surrounded by his legal team and they had you sign this NDA. Can you tell our listeners the terms of this NDA that they had you sign?
Yes, absolutely. I'd be happy to talk about it. I think we have already spoken in this podcast about the ways in which the culture of Hollywood and the environment kept survivors silenced or not working or unable to come forward with their stories. So obviously, Zelda Perkins and I were subject to that as well. But then in addition to that, we had a very real and practical imprisonment in this NDA, in the sense that it was a legal document that compelled us never, ever to speak again of any detail of working for Harvey. It was our own lawyers that said to us upon signing the NDA that we had to treat this time of working for Harvey Weinstein as a black hole in our lives. The extent to which the NDA covered who we could and could not tell was criminal, I believe. Criminal, abhorrent, immoral. The first thing I want to mention is we had a Schedule 5 that listed all of our friends and family who had known that I'd worked for Harvey and who knew anything about the assault on any level. And so obviously the first person on that list for me was my partner, my boyfriend at the time, whose name was Chris. The second person was my best friend at the time. But then it went on to list every single family member or friend that I had mentioned that I was working for Harvey or said anything had untoward had happened in Venice. I think the idea that they had tried to take the names and addresses of each person that was close to us was terrifying. There were things that were said that Harvey, who are you? Who are you and Zelda? Harvey can make you disappear. Harvey can make your friends and family disappear. Harvey knows where your boyfriend lives. Harvey knows where your sister lives. Harvey knows where your parents are.
That's criminal. There's no question about it. That is criminal. That's a threat.
That's right. And what does that mean? He can destroy you. He can make you does it mean you won't work again? Or does that mean you're literally going to physically disappear? Are you going to disappear under a London bus? You know, it was never very clear, but it was certainly incredibly sinister. So that was on a personal level. And I want to say that first and foremost, because I think in a lot of interviews that I hear Jodie and Megan give, they often talk about, well, these women were imprisoned by a very real legal and financial repercussion. That's also true. I'm about to get onto the legal
legal and financial repercussions. But I first and foremost want to forefront the very personal and visceral physical fear of your friends and family being listed on a 30-page legal document. Then I want to go on to say it was a legal document that forbade us from talking to doctors, to other lawyers. That's illegal too. You know, we've signed a legal document with some lawyers that coerced us. We weren't allowed to keep a copy of this legal document. We weren't allowed to seek further legal representation on a document that we signed that we couldn't keep a copy of. We weren't allowed to talk to Inland Revenue. If they ever questioned about the settlement agreement or a sum of money that was settled, we weren't allowed to talk to tax officials. They had to be referred back to Harvey's lawyers. Any lawyers that came to talk to us had to be referred back to Harvey's lawyers. Not only that, then there was a whole section that dealt with the forms of media which we could not engage with. And it literally listed them all out. It said television, newspaper, journalists, radio, podcasts, books, movies, depictions, fictional accounts, and any other media that has not yet been invented. We were not allowed to discuss the whole world of media. We had to deny what happened. If anyone on our Schedule 5, our personal friends and family, or anyone at all, implied that Harvey had done anything untoward, Zelda and I were legally obliged to defend Miramax Films and Harvey Weinstein. Think about the implications of that.
They're telling you to lie.
If my own mother had, for some reason, she's terribly shy, so she wouldn't do this, but if my own mother had gone to the Sun and said, I believe Harvey Weinstein has assaulted my daughter, I would have to stand up in a court of law and say she was lying and Harvey's a good guy.
Absolutely illegal to put that in a document. I mean, that is a crime. And that should invalidate the whole thing.
One of the first things I did before I even came public with my story, once the New York Times article was published in 2017, I'm often asked, what did I do in the 2 years of silence? You know, there were sort of 2 years of absolute silence, and then there were 2 years of what's called privacy. So there's 20 years of silence, 2 years of private, 20 years when I was silent, 2 years when I was private, and 3 years now of having gone public. But people often ask, what were you doing between 2017 and 2019 as you were thinking about going public? But one of the things we looked at was, could Zelda and I sue Bob Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, Miramax Films, Steve Hutensky, any of the parties that signed this contract with us? Because I thought that it was incredible that such a contract existed and could in any way be legally enforceable. But I want to tell you that we sat in an office with top London lawyers. Allen and Overy are a respected London law firm. They're still running as a respected London law firm. They are so-called one of the top five magic circle firms. They sat there and they endorsed this NDA. Not only that, but as Harvey came forward to sign the NDA, he made some burbling speech about how much he admired Zelda and I, how he thought we were very smart. But there's also a very important part of his speech where he said, I am a person with a lot of power. I don't understand consent. I don't. So he sat in a room full of 30 senior lawyers from Allen and Overy. He admitted to having done a sexual act without fully understanding consent. Not one of those lawyers said, I'm sorry, we can't do this. We can't visit this on these two young, terrified women who are sitting here who are 24 and 25. We need to call the Met Police. We need to call Scotland. Nobody said that. No one said this is a criminal matter. No one said that, I'm sorry, we can't be part of this NDA, that this legal document is an atrocity. It's all about money. Thank you, Jim. Exactly. Nobody stood up because Harvey was basically writing a bottomless check to everyone in that room.
Folks, listen to what Rowena just said. For me, she was not allowed to go to a fucking therapist after being sexually assaulted. That tells you everything you need to know about how these people see women, how they see victims, and how separated they are from their humanity. It is absolutely unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
And he admitted it. He admitted it in the room. People just went ahead and signed it anyway. It's just staggering.
And you know, literally, I believe that they were involved in a crime. That those lawyers that coerced you to do it. Who told you to sign that? Did they assign you lawyers that advised you to do this?
Everybody told us to sign it. I'm sorry, but everybody did. We went to see Donna Gelotti, who produced Shakespeare in Love. She said, go get a lawyer. Nobody's going to believe you. Our own lawyers said, we don't believe you either, but if you want to sign an NDA, do it. Nobody believed us. We're two young women up against Harvey Weinstein. Is anybody going to believe us?
Unbelievable.
No, Jim, I was part of the RICO class action that was brought against Harvey Weinstein. We believed it was organized crime. We believed we had a case, and our judge threw out every defendant that was not Harvey. And then he threw out every woman who was outside of the statute of limitations. And they only, me and two other women remained because we were trafficked. We fell under federal sex trafficking laws because we were compelled to cross state lines.
Right.
Clearly was a criminal operation. In Zelda's and Rowena's story, it's very clear. In the organization around Harvey that allowed him to continue to do this because people were financially benefiting, this was clearly an organized criminal operation. And the law hasn't caught up with seeing things like this that way.
Absolutely. We have
to be pushing towards changing legislation or things will never change.
Yeah, well, I feel exactly the same. I tried to do the same with the Catholic Church. And so did, I mean, separately, Francie Hakes tried to do it in the Justice Department. I tried to do it in the FBI because exactly that. Victims are transported across state lines. It should be a RICO case because the Catholic Church has put up an iron wall. And, you know, they send documents out of the country. They lock everything down. They collect everything away from the parishes where these things happen. They move these guys around interstate. It's the same kind of thing. It's a huge, it's not a conspiracy in terms of, oh, hey, let's do something bad. Let's be bad people doing bad things. They think they're good people. They think they're protecting an organization that is above reproach. But in fact, what they're protecting is a policy and a pattern of behavior that continues to victimize very vulnerable people, whether they're children or whether they're young adults, whether they're old people, they're still human beings that are being persecuted and assaulted by people in a power position in an organization that they want to perpetuate.
I also attempted the RICO argument. I attempted to argue that I was moved from London to Venice in a form of human trafficking, sex trafficking. That fell on its face as well. I concur with what Sarah Ann said about her case. We reported Mark Mansell, who was the lead partner in Allen and Overy, for being the architect of the NDA. The Solicitors Regulatory Authority said he his health was too poor for him to really be thoroughly investigated. I have attempted to speak against Steve Tensky, who signed every single page of my NDA, that is also, you know, that falls on deaf ears. So, you know, Harvey has become the figurehead. You know, he's taken the hit, and the enablers still continue to thrive in Hollywood. We have to roll up our sleeves. We have a lot of work to do.
Amazing. Well, I have to say, not only do I applaud you, I'm sure all of us do, for your, you know, your energy and your enthusiasm and your dedication to this cause, because I know it's difficult. I know that this is work and it's pushing that boulder up the hill. And many times you don't get results and, you know, it feels like it's going to come back and crush you. So thank you for sticking with it.
And also just to say, it takes all of us, doesn't it? It takes all of us to stand up and be counted. And I think that's really important when we're hearing about the ecosystem, the enablers, those who enable and green light, or those who consciously choose to ignore and excuse. So for me, that institutionalized grooming is what I call it, and coercive control. And Rowena, you spoke to that so well, the fear when it's not just you that's being named, it's your boyfriend, it's your mother, it's your best friend. And those people are being used as levers against you to silence you. And that is a very terrifying situation, particularly when you're young and you're starting out on your career. And people don't always see it like that. But the male privilege, the male entitlement, it is men who hold this power. We can't fall into the trap of, you know, and I almost said it, Rowena, were there women in the room? Were there women lawyers at Allen and Overy?
There were.
And there probably were.
There were.
And they're all part of that same fabric, that same ecosystem, that same, that's driven by the money rather than doing the right thing.
Absolutely staggering. Absolutely staggering.
Well, they all allowed a serial perpetrator to carry on. And I must admit, going back to the trials, I followed the New York trial closely. I gave my 2 cents on it every day because I knew all the dirty tactics that would be used to Darvo each victim, which is exactly what happened. And then the LA trial, I spoke to Lou Godbold about just the male lawyers, the defense. Did you hear Lou talk?
And, she's incredible.
You know,
We love Liz.
Absolutely amazing. I interviewed her on Crime Analyst, and we talked about the defense tactics of triggering the survivor's PTS intentionally.
Yeah.
And all of those things that happen. And I too find it remarkable, given his serial perpetration, given his behavior that we know about, and yet women's testimonies are still being questioned and discredited, even though there was more of a majority to guilty on each count. That wasn't the overall result or the overall outcome. And of course, we still await sentencing. But I was, and Lou, we were very perplexed about what happened there.
And just to return to your point about were there women lawyers in the room, it was a woman lawyer, I want to make the point, who said, I don't understand why Zelda and Rowena would need therapy. They've got the money, haven't they? So it's not just men that are enablers. There are female enablers. I mean, look at the comments that Donna Rutino made. I wouldn't be a woman that would go up to the hotel room. And I think that's why it's incredibly complicated. It's not a simplistic issue of female victims or female survivors up against a system of male entitlement and male enablers. It's much more complicated than that. It's about changing hearts and minds in society as a whole across the gender spectrum. And that makes it far more complicated. It's not a simple fairy tale of monsters and princesses anymore. It's a really complex web of assumptions and baked in prejudices that will take generations, I think, to change slowly.
It will take time, although I will just lay out my own stall on what I believe in having changed laws 8 times to better protect women and children is that systems and processes are created by men to protect men. They're not created for women, and our lived experiences are not acknowledged within those systems. So I do see it, actually, that we are trying to ensure women's voices are included in law changes and that our nuanced experience is recognized in these male structures and these male dominated systems and processes. I mean, let's not forget women, you know, right now don't hold their own reproductive autonomy in some parts of the US. They don't have power and agency over their own reproductive health. Well, that is a major problem. So I do think that this is about equality across the board and that we do have to keep challenging and changing laws to better reflect our experiences, all of our lived experiences of abuse.
What I want to say about the trial is, first of all, I think lawyers who engage in those bad faith victim blaming tactics should lose their ability to practice law, because it's afactual, it's abusive, and it's wildly unhelpful. But an insight I've had about victim blaming, which, you know, sometimes some of the worst victim blaming I've heard has been from other women, I honestly think it comes from a place of fear and wanting to feel like you have control. I think there's this thing where people hear a bad thing happened to you, Sarah. Okay. What did you do so that I can avoid it? Maybe if I can avoid, maybe I'll make better decisions that will keep me safe. And so what I think comes from a similar kind of fear and trauma response translates into something harmful towards survivors of violent crime. It really is that person's brain a lot of the time trying to make sense of something that doesn't make sense and trying to figure out how they can protect themselves. So
absolutely,
I try to come at it from a place of empathy when I hear it sometimes, if I think it's being argued in good faith, and try to reach people on a different level and sort of unpack where that's coming from. And you're right, Laura, it's baked into our culture and our society. We're all conditioned with it from birth, and it takes work to unpick that. And it takes Rowena, you continuing to tell your story, and other survivors and myself talking about the truth of what it is to be a survivor, the fear that comes with trying to tell your story, the multi-system damage that happens, that I think that's the stuff that starts to get to people and make them realize these are individual humans behind these stories. It's not a monolith. It's not a faceless crowd. These are real people and real impacts. And I that's why I think it's so important to keep talking. So thanks for listening to us.
And whilst we have misogynists, self-professed misogynists like Andrew Tate, captivating billions of people and that being seen as acceptable, unfortunately, that allows serial perpetrators to thrive. It greenlights them. that's the challenge that we have current day with influencers and the types of messages that people are receiving and what we value. And unfortunately, I don't believe we value women and girls' experiences. And that's what we're fighting for every day. Although that having been said, male victims, of course, I support them too. But I do feel that we have a huge problem around misogyny and male abuse and violence towards women and how we excuse the behavior, but yet how we're quick to blame the victim.
Yeah, it happened. It's the most recent, very public example is how people are attacking one of the surviving members of who lived in the house in Idaho. Yeah. And the fact that she saw this guy leave with a mask on and she was creeped out or freaked out or scared by him and closed the door. They're blaming her for not doing something about it. Well, I don't think they understand what the average woman goes through in college, how many times they are in situations where they're frightened or creeped out and they need to protect themselves. Of course, her brain didn't go to, oh, a random person just came in the house and murdered four of my roommates. She would never have thought of that. If she had known that, she would have acted differently. What she felt was, my instinct is telling me this guy is not good. I am going to lock myself away from him. Now, he could have been a delivery person. He could have been a friend of one of her roommates. He could have been somebody who was there partying with somebody. Who knows what was going through her mind? But we do know that she did lock herself away. She got that instinct and she followed it, which is something she should do. But you can't blame her for what this scumbag did, for what this asshole did for his own reasons. It's not her fault that she didn't know he was there to kill people. Mm-hmm. It's not her fault in any way. But the victim blaming that goes on is reprehensible. It just adds to the level of the crime. And, you know, it happens, you know, it happens very often. And I don't think that the people who are doing it fully understand what the experience is, because college and universities are target rich environments for offenders. And so the experience of many women at school is going to be one of being targeted. And so she felt that way. She got out of the way. Fortunately, she wasn't harmed. And fortunately, the other roommate was also not harmed. And they're not at all to blame for what that guy did.
No. Well said, Jim. So I just want to thank our guests today, Sarah Ann and Rowena. I'm just in awe of you. I am so glad that you are sharing your story, that you are unsilenced and unmasked, and the world is getting to know you and your voices, and we are never going to go back, right? And you're continuing the fight for all of us, for all of us. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like listening to our show and appreciate the work that Jim and Laura do and their expertise, you can do us a big favor. Please head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our pod and leave us a 5-star rating and write your thoughts about why you enjoy our show. It really, really is important and helps other people find us. Also, did you know that you can share our episode? It is so easy. On the Apple Podcast app, click the 3 dots drop-down menu and you'll see an option to share to your socials or to a particular person, and then they can hear for themselves why you love listening to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for your support.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.